So my name is Greg. I'm a security engineer at Google. And for the past couple of years or so, I've been the OS X security guy. So I've been looking after the security of our OS X fleet. Work really closely with Clay and Ed, who've just spoken. And I thought I might start out with a quick show of hands. So who has Macs in their organization at all? So like almost everyone, right? So who manages Macs to like some extent? So like you at least say maybe install a standard set of applications when you provision it, when you hand out a laptop. It's like a little few less. Who can modify a configuration in some way? So like you have something like Puppet or something else that you can use to twiddle a configuration.
Working towards it.
Okay. Who can force a patch install? So make sure a patch is installed by this date. Okay. And who can do that without a corp network?
What?
Without a corporate network. So like just over the internet, that's it.
Some.
All right. Awesome. So like actually see. Sorry.
We developed
our own CM tool to do just that. Awesome. Okay. I actually expected only to see Google Hands up then. So that was really good. So I'm basically, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to basically assume that you can do at least the first couple of those things. So you can change a configuration, you can force a patch, that kind of stuff. So I'm going to talk about what to do next once you've got those basic capabilities. I'm going to talk about some of the built-in stuff that we either extend or use or configure or enforce in some way. And I'm also going to talk about some of the kind of a little bit more out there stuff that we've been doing with OS X hardening at Google. So really briefly in Firewall 2, Ed and Clay have covered this. So for anyone watching the recording, you should just go look see their talk probably. It's super important to have full disk encryption for a global fleet of laptops. As I said, it was missing some escrow features that we liked, cauliflower vest, all of these things. So just to pick out a couple of things I don't think they mentioned. So there's a user notification when there's a key retrieval, which is really nice. So if you're at a tech support and the tech is helping you and they retrieve your key, then the user gets a email notification that that's happened. And there's also a way of that the support staff can unlock the volume without actually exposing the token, which is kind of nice. So that's like a fairly basic security measure you're going to need. So kind of stepping up a layer and talking about some, or a few layers, I'm going to talk about a couple of technologies about that are aimed at kind of preventing badness or keeping badness off the platform. The first of which is Gatekeeper. And it's really targeting this mass malware that we've seen for OS X. So the something along the lines of a user socially engineered to visit a website. That website convinces them, hey, you need this, you need Flash to view this content. And the user will dutifully go and download something that looks like Flash, but it's actually this Flashback Trojan. And this is a little screenshot of what the installer looks like. So it's been mocked up to look a lot like Flash and trick users into downloading and installing it. And this is where the kind of malware that Gatekeeper is targeting. So the way it works is applications that run on the OS opt in by setting this value in info.plist. So if you look at Chrome and Safari, you'll see this file quarantine enabled key set in that plist. And other applications, Apple's actually forced them into it. They basically kind of said via this exceptions plist, all these things should also be using this this Gatekeeper tool. So things like other browsers and a bunch of torrent clients are in this exceptions list. And so what happens is if you're opted into this Gatekeeper program, any files that get created by that program are tainted. So it's the idea is like this thing is dirty. It's come from the internet. It needs more inspection. And that's done by using a HFS plus file system attribute. So the user downloads a file, it gets tainted with this attribute. When they go to run it, launch services forces a check of the signature of that file. So if it's signed by Apple or signed by a registered developer that's got a certificate from Apple, in the default settings, then it'll let it run. Otherwise, it'll block it. And a block looks like this. Last week, at least when I downloaded Wireshark, it wasn't signed. But there's also actually quite a few caveats around this too. So it really is just this download and run kind of malware. Like if you run that application by the command line, if you call it from POSIX APIs, if for some reason you're calling from shellcode or something like that, Gatekeeper is not going to apply in any of those cases. And there's currently lots of unsigned software out there. So everything in the Apple Store is forced to be signed, but everything else, it just really varies. So major software tends to be signed, but I guess less used stuff tends not to be at the moment. And the analogy I kind of draw at the moment is that it feels like the bad old days of the web where you went to a bunch of SSL sites and maybe half of them gave you cert warnings. And so users just kind of got trained to ignore these cert warnings. I see these all the time. So there's a little bit of that going on with Gatekeeper at the moment. And so this is a way to just enforce that it's on and that the it's the Apple plus registered developer setting that is enforced. So moving on to the next kind of detecting and neutralizing badness technology, I'm going to talk about XProtect. And it's OS X's built-in antivirus. It actually has a lot of the same caveats to Gatekeeper about the way the programs are run, having to be tainted with this file system attribute. And compared to, I guess, what you might be familiar with third-party AVs, it's pretty small. So there's like 40 signatures in this plist. And the update frequency is pretty low. But it does have some interesting features. So one thing that was used to great effect when there were a bunch of Java compromises, Java web plugin vulnerabilities and compromises going on, Apple introduced this minimum plugin bundle version thing, which it used XProtect to enforce. And it's basically said, don't run Java that's before this version number. And that was actually really quite a good way to break Java. Unfortunately, it did pretty much break Java for a lot of people. I know like security people were very happy when this happened. I think a lot of sysadmins were less happy. But this is so simple and so configurable that it makes me think that maybe we can manage this plist ourselves. And if we know that software X is horribly vulnerable before version Y, then we can enforce that we never run anything less than version Y on our platform. Haven't tried that yet, but I think it should work. A detection looks like this, so you have some options about what to do. And a signature looks like this. Again, actually super simple configuration. It's hard to read, but the things in bold there are a type match and then a byte string match. So both of those things need to hit for this to fire. This happens to be a malicious Java file, a malicious jar, so a Java archive. And the pattern is just match these bytes, then the curly braces, 4 bytes is a wildcard. So any 4 bytes, these bytes, 12 bytes of wildcard, etc. So pretty simple. And actually so simple, in fact, that it makes me think the same thing, that maybe we can use this ourselves. And why would we want to do that? So, I mean, if we had some malware, why wouldn't we just give it to Apple and get them to write the signature? And yeah, we probably would do that, but it might be more interesting for something like, I don't know, maybe we want to log or quarantine every package or dimage or whatever that has the phrase keygen in it. Because we know these are like always loaded with malware, and people are trying to pirate software or something by downloading these things. It's pretty much always bad. And you know, you could never deploy that kind of string worldwide as like an Apple XProtect signature. But for our organization, it might be interesting if we could do that. Unfortunately, we kind of can't at the moment. And the blockers are that there's no log recorded, actually. So if you untick that report to Apple tick box, there's nothing. There's no record that this ever happened. It just kind of goes away. So there's nothing written in a log anywhere. If the box is ticked, you get quite a nice little log entry about what happened. So that's kind of a killer for this. It needs to be logged for it to work. And we'd also probably need to disable the report to Apple because we'd be reporting a lot of rubbish probably that may or may not be malware. And it'd be nice to be able to load the signatures from a separate plist so we can manage it separately and not have to splice in any updates that Apple makes to that same plist. So that's kind of how we'd like to use XProtect, but we can't really at the moment. So that's talking about kind of a couple of technologies of preventing badness that are built in. And this is kind of the next technology is talking about, I'm going to talk about is more about making sure that good things don't go bad. So this is application sandboxing. So what is that and why? Why would you use it? The idea is that you tightly define what your application does in its normal state. So you say it normally creates network connections, it creates processes, it writes files in these locations, this kind of thing. And then if there's a vulnerability in that software and malware wants to take it over and use it, then the idea is that they'll probably be blocked by this sandbox. They'll probably want to do something extra that your application doesn't normally do. Maybe they want to create like a new launch daemon. Maybe they want to install a malicious cron entry, something along those lines. And so the idea is that this sandbox then makes it much harder for the person attacking the software to make use of those vulnerabilities. And you can see this in major apps. So all the App Store apps now have to have it. And the kind of major software vendors are pretty much all using sandboxes. You can find them and use the share sandbox. And Apple's put a lot of work into making sandboxing fairly simple for developers in Xcode. I'm going to talk about, we've been putting some effort into sandboxing our own management daemons and tools. So from Clay and Ed's talk, you know that we run quite a few like custom things that are watching various things, a few management tools. So we've been working on sandboxing some of those where it makes sense. And the basic kind of process is you create this really simple sandbox file that just says trace what happens that looks like this, just these two lines. And then you run the binary that you want to trace with this simple sandbox file. And it's going to spit out a ton of events. And the idea is you exercise the functionality of that binary. It logs everything it does. Then you can run sandbox simplify on it, which will kind of dedupe a bunch of stuff and make it a bit more manageable. And then you, at the end of that, you basically have a starting point for a sandbox to describe that application. And you might need to do more exercising and more testing, and you probably also want to do a fair bit of simplification by hand as well. But that's kind of the basic steps. So we've done that with some of our own tools, and it's actually quite easy when they're launched, they're like launched-y stuff that is a launch services item, because we can run it with sandbox exec. And they're usually fairly single-purpose. Most of the things with sandbox anyway are. But we had a try at sandboxing some third-party stuff. So this is the case where you know you wish the developer was shipping a sandbox, but they're not. So we've attempted to kind of stick them into a sandbox using this sandbox exec method. But it's really actually pretty terrible at the moment. It's not easy to use. You have to kind of catch all the different ways that that application can be executed. And I don't know, it feels like kind of not the right way to sandbox an app. It'd be much nicer if you could convince the developer to take on the management burden of sandboxing their own stuff. And sandbox is definitely not perfect. I know actually Dan Kaminsky mentioned this in his talk this morning, but I'd also recommend looking at Medea. Medea's presentation at RuxCon this year. He's another security engineer out of Sydney. He looked at OS X sandboxing in some depth, and he also talked about some vulnerabilities he found via fuzzing the mark message parsing. So that's kind of the end of the built-in stuff and how we configure it and use it or how we would like to use it if it's not possible at the moment. So I'm going to move on to talking about some of the extra hardening bits that we've been doing. starting with web plugins, and I think like these two kind of websites kind of sum up what's been happening with Java web plugins over the past year. So if you've been paying attention to any security press, you've probably heard about Java vulnerabilities and Java some fairly high-profile compromises due to those vulnerabilities. The first website here, Is There Java Zero Day, is just like a countdown clock for how long it's been since the last one. Oh, actually, no. Is there Java 0 day? Is just you go there and it just says yes. and Java 0 day is a countdown clock. It's like, you know, days since last accident, kind of, you know, days since last Java 0 day. So given all the movement in this space, I thought I'd just kind of give a quick summary of like the Java defenses that we have at the moment for OS 10. So to start with, it's no longer installed by default, so that's great. There's the XProtect minimum version requirement. I already mentioned kind of how that worked. Firefox Click to Play is on by default, and it's also on in Chrome, Click to Play by default, but there's no 64-bit Chrome for OS 10, and there's only 64-bit Java on recent versions, so sad face. NS Security Plugin Wrapper is an open source tool, and it uses the Netscape plugin API, MP API, to wrap the Java plugin, and actually any plugin that works kind of with that interface. Which means that it works with a bunch of different plugins. It also works on Linux. And I'm going to describe how that works and how you configure it in a little bit more detail in just a sec. And there's been a bunch of different kind of security enhancements that have been bundled with Java. So now there's this deployment rule set whitelisting thing, which basically allows you to say, this ancient version of Java with this website is OK, but no other tuples are okay. And there's also a JRE expiration date, so that after a certain time, so I think it's with the latest update, it was 3 months. So they give you 3 months to update to the new version, and then after that, if your security level settings are at a certain level, you won't be able to call the plugin from JavaScript anymore after that 3 month period. So NS Security, just a quick example config. So the kind of most important line here is load plugin that says, this is the plugin I want to wrap. NS Security will register the MIME handlers, whatever MIME handlers that plugin exposes. And then when it comes time to load the website, it'll look at the MIME handlers it has and look at the allowed domains. So if you're on java.com and you're trying to execute Java, it's going to let it go through because it's in the allowed domain list. If you're on a different website, then it'll block it. If you have syslog policy decisions on, it'll log all those allow or denies into the log. And if you set a notify command, then when it actually blocks something, that you can basically notify the user, hey, you know, this was blocked for this reason. Go here for more details if you need this website or something. So that's basically how NS Security works. I've got links at the end of the presentation to where these various bits of open source stuff is that I'm mentioning. So I wanted to talk about, so kind of keeping with web plugins, I wanted to talk about making a big security change. You know, we talked a lot about Java defenses. So the next logical question that most people have is, well, okay, that's like one big complicated web plugin that's fairly widely deployed. The other elephant in the room is Flash. So, you know, like, there's a history of vulnerabilities. It was actually a significant portion of our must push this patch right now patching load. Is there something we can do about Flash? And when I talk about big, I mean big as in like people will notice if it goes badly. So what about Flash? So why don't we try uninstalling Flash? That sounds super crazy. It's a core web plugin. It's used all over the internet. Are we just going to break everyone's web experience? But maybe not so much. So Chrome sandboxes Flash for starters. So we have a safer way to run Flash than just like the regular Flash plugin. It's just distributed completely separately from Adobe's Flash. Ships by default with Chrome. Turns out our Chrome adoption is pretty high. So maybe this isn't so crazy. Maybe we can just tell people if they want to use Flash, then they do it in Chrome. Otherwise, you know, bad luck. So I wanted to run through the process of kind of, so we actually did this. I wanted to run through the process of kind of how we did it and what that looks like, because it's kind of a recipe for the more impactful security changes that we've made. And so we started out with, what's the impact of this change? How many people are we going to affect? So we had Flash installed on about half our fleet. So it's like 20,000 people or so. So it was a lot of people. So we're going to need a self-service exemption to start with. So we want, if we're going to break something like this, we want people to be able to get out of that hole really quickly. So we want people to be able to get back to work really fast, and we're going to start out with something really easy so that they can exempt themselves quickly and get back to work. And I think I'm just going to call out this a bit more too, because I think with a lot of security changes, they actually live or die based on like what their exemption process is like. If that process is low friction and people can get back to work and get back to what they were doing, and maybe you can get like 80% of the organization, then you've still won. And you know, you can iterate on this process and reduce those use cases. But when you first start out, if people hate you, like, and you have no good way for them to get out of the hole they're in, then that probably kills that security change. So. And so we reach out to power users before we do anything. So we say, hey, you know, like, we know you guys are the people who are going to pick up pitchforks, you're going to light your torches, and you're going to come after us when we do this. So run this command, exempt yourself before this date. And so we'll kind of dodge a bullet there to start with. Then we canary the change. So we'll run on 1% of the fleet, gradually increase that a little bit until we get, you know, enough installs to see are there problems with this. We look at our logs. How many re-enables did we get? How many people were frustrated? Were there people yelling on mailing lists? Were there bugs filed? This sort of thing. Looks okay. So we proceed to like a stable release after a few iterations. We have a change release email that goes out every time we do a stable release that kind of notes the differences that we've made, some of the tweaks that we made for the platform. And no one reads that. So the next step is when we actually do the change, we have to give an on-host notification. So we say, hey, we just broke Flash. Here's why. Go to this website to find out how to re-enable it. And find out, yeah, why we did it and how you can re-enable it if you need to. So that means that people don't just get into this endless loop of like installing Flash, we uninstall it, and then they don't know what's wrong, and then they install it again, then we uninstall it. And we monitor the re-enable rate. So we have this like easy exemption process. So we want to know how many people are pushing that button. Are we actually making a real security change here, or are we just wasting our time? And turns out this worked. So we remove basically all our Flash. And no one really complained. So that's a pretty good success story, I think. So the this is a time series graph. It's hard to see, but the big drop is within about a week. So within about a week or so, all our Flash is gone. OK. So I'm about to talk about kind of switch gears. So I mentioned for Flash, like one of the very important things there was that we got good logs, so that we had some measure of who's re-enabling, how many uninstalls we're getting, that sort of thing. So I'm going to talk about logging in just a second. But before I get there, I wanted to kind of give some background. And a number of speakers from Google have spoken about this. Jan and Harold covered it in a lot of detail. I'm just going to mention some security-relevant angles of this idea of getting rid of the corporate network, that everything needs to be done over the internet. So we want to be able to apply patches just with an internet connection. So you know, you could be on 4G Wi-Fi in the middle of nowhere, and you'll still get patched. And we do that with Monkey and Simeon, as Ed and Clay mentioned. Tweak configurations, so it's going to be standalone Puppet that will allow us to do that. That's what we're working towards. Collect logs, and this is an internal tool for now. Respond to incidents. We use an open source tool that was written by Googlers. I'm actually one of the developers for this project now. It's called GER, which is a recursive acronym for GER Rapid Response. it's open source. I've got a link at the end. And that allows us to do instant response basically wherever there's the internet. And heaps more, without needing to be in an office or on VPN or anything. But that's the kind of security relevant bits. So talking about logs, we collect a few. It's about a billion lines a day just from our corp max. So it's a fair few logs that we're kind of streaming over the internet. And of course, we have like strong access control and approvals process and usage auditing on all our logs. But I wanted to talk about like one of the main contributors actually to the our logging load is our use of AuditD, which is an implementation of Sun's basic security module. It was written by McAfee under contract to Apple for the OS X Panther common criteria evaluation. So it's actually fairly old now. But it's a huge, amazing treasure trove of logs for security people. It's great for detection, incident response. And this is kind of where that streaming logs over the internet really, really comes in. You want that delay between when this thing happened, when it was logged, and when we got that log centrally to be as short as possible for your detection and incident response process to be as agile and on top of attackers as much as possible. It also means like the quicker you ship that log off, the less chance the attacker has to mess with it on the machine too. So these are the sort of things that you can log with OpenVSM. This is like maybe less than 10% of the kind of huge menu of logging event types you can add. So you can imagine like you know every network connection, every process execution, it's really powerful logging capabilities here. And just to give you like a little bit of a cheesy example, here's a process execution logging, me creating this kind of like one-line implant using nano editing a cron tab. So I create this cron tab entry, and then shortly after you see this this download of totallylegit.com something.php getting piped into bash, which is probably a bad sign. Although it is totally legit, so I mean maybe it's okay. So problems wish list, kind of a bit of both. So at the moment it's a binary log, which is kind of a pain in the ass. It would be nice if you could just configure it to say log into syslog, which we're already collecting. Well, failing that, like the tool that converts binary log to human readable log is called PR Audit, and it's super slow and super CPU intensive. I think with a bit of developer love and maybe a refactor, that could go a lot faster. It would be nice to have better filtering pre-storage. So at the moment, you can say like you know every network socket connect or something, but you can't say don't worry about these IP addresses. That's always boring, or something along those lines. To have like a finer grained control on exactly what you're logging and to reduce that volume a bit, there's a tool called Audit Reduce that takes a binary log, applies some basic filters, and spits out a filtered binary log. But really, I just want that built in to the system. So when I configure it, I specify here are my filters, and I can filter arbitrary stuff. At the moment, audit reduces kind of limited fields that you can filter. So I wanted to leave you with a to-do list, starting with some management fundamentals. So I mentioned this at the start, but I mean, really, this is kind of like the basics you need. You need to be able to push a patch really quickly. So if there's that new zero day that you know like has just been patched and it's some critical component that's on every machine, you need that out like in less than 24 hours. You need a capability to change configurations. Otherwise, all of this is kind of pointless. If you can't modify a value in a plist somewhere or change how software is installed or something along those lines, you're not going to be able to do a lot. Collecting logs over the internet, as I mentioned, is really important. Collecting machine information, so install stats was really important for the flash change, and also a number of other people have mentioned kind of inventory information as being a key point for both management and security. So that's kind of the management pieces for the OS X hardening. And the rest is, I'd use Chrome as your browser, just saying. shameless plug. Remove, disable, contain dangerous browser plugins. Get an instant response capability. Again, a shameless plug since I work on this tool. Take a look at OpenVSM logging. Look at the events that are available there. You probably want to define a custom event class and turn on the firehose. Make sure firewall 2 full disk encryption is on, gatekeepers enforcing, and sandbox your tools kind of wherever it makes sense. That's all I have. I'm going to take any questions.
David Lin, Vanderbilt University. So if you're accepting log information from any machine on the internet, how do you prevent your nation state attacker from just over blowing out your log server?
So we use SSL and client-side certs to authenticate, so it's encrypted, and we're not just streaming plain text logs. Yeah.
So do you buffer and then when the machine's offline, buffer, and then look for the network to come back?
Okay. Right. Yeah.
And then for, you mentioned Puppet, are you trusting Puppet's certs to be your end-all, be-all of security?
No.
Okay. Because that's my fear as well. Like, right. I've seen their security history.
Right. So, so exposing your Puppet server to the internet is not a thing I would recommend. You know? And trusting that cert process where you can kind of basically just get a cert for any machine is not the way to do it either. So at the moment, we have a shim that sits in front of Puppet that does the same thing. It uses a cert that we already use for other things that we issue ourselves.
Right.
And we proxy through, basically, an SSL connection to our Puppet server. Okay. But that's kind of going to go away. And the idea is that what Clay and Ed talked about is going to standalone Puppet, where basically we distribute the manifest down to the client.
Right.
And so we'll do that over SSL as well. But we distribute that manifest down, and then everything with Puppet just happens locally. At that point, we don't need to have these kind of proxies and this sort of stuff going on.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Okay.
I feel strange. I don't have to bend down to talk in the mic. Of the standard OSX tools, you didn't mention the firewall. I'm just assuming that it's on. Or have you guys done anything cool, like ripped it out and replaced it with something else?
No, we haven't replaced it. I mean, yeah, it's on. I don't have a whole lot more to say about firewalls. I think, yeah, the security value of firewalls is not enormous, unfortunately.
Rick Farrow, do you do anything along the lines of HIDs, for example, when Flashback came out, it went in there and it added new LaunchD, which really replaces cron, right? And this is how it restarted.
Right.
So do you watch anything in particular?
Yeah, we watch a lot of stuff.
Are you using, then I suppose you could use your audit D to watch things like that.
Right.
I hadn't
really
thought
of that.
That's
definitely
now.
One way to catch that. Mm-hmm. We have a few other ways too, but if you look at the menu of events from audit D, the process execution one will probably catch that. You could also look for file writes under the launch services kind of launch agents, launch daemons kind of directory structure. And I think there might also actually be particular events around launch services as well that you can log with audit D. So there's a lot of ways to detect that sort of stuff with the OpenBSM framework.
So you are collecting a lot of audit information,
it
sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Thanks.